Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. 4 weeks ago, we began discussing threats to the independence of the judiciary. In our first broadcast, we focused upon District Attorney Brooke Jenkins, the extent that she's been calling out individual judges before crowds are in the media. And of course, the law does not allow judges to respond. In the second broadcast in this series, we looked at a growing practice of weaponizing the peremptory challenge, in essence, challenging a sitting judge and making him or her unavailable for criminal cases or civil cases, as the case may be. The pressures on the bench that challenge the ability of the court to provide a fair and impartial judge is neither local nor limited to criminal prosecutions. The president has recently taken to the bully pulpit to criticize judges who have questioned the manner in which some of the administration's policy initiatives have been carried out, even going so far as to call upon Congress to impeach judges for so ruling on the cases to which they've been assigned. Tonight, we're going to take a step back to discuss whether the case is criminal or civil, about freedom or money, or the workings of our government. Why is it so important to have an impartial judiciary? Next week, we conclude this series with a look at the administration stifling any opposition by attacking the law firms and lawyers who represent folks adversely affected by the president's initiatives. But tonight on Your Legal Rights, we look at whether or not following the agenda of an elected official, whether it be a local prosecutor or the president of the United States, whether that criticism or whether that ruling is truly good cause to recall the judge or call for impeachment, or is merely one branch of government attacking another from fulfilling its constitutional duty. What is the role of the court? Why is it so important to have judges of varying backgrounds and ideas, not all of one mindset or blindly following the administration? As always, tonight we have a panel of outstanding experts here to guide us sort things out. It would be hard to envision greater expertise than we have in the room, than we have in tonight's guests, right here, right now. But of course, our final and most important guest is all of you, and there's much to discuss. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. If you want to call in a related question, you want to talk about the court or its place in society or exactly what we're talking about, what is its role in our democracy, you don't have to jump in exactly where we may be in our conversation. And do bear in mind that our guests are here to educate, inform, perhaps even entertain. But they can't provide specific legal advice about your case. They haven't seen your case. They haven't seen all the facts. Joining us tonight, Judge Stephen Kaus served as a judge of the Superior Court of California, County of Alameda, for 12 years, where he managed a direct calendar department with 600 to 800 cases, overseeing complex multi-party and two-party disputes, while conducting numerous trials and settlement conferences. Before his judicial career, Judge Kaus served as a deputy public defender in Contra Costa County, transitioning to civil litigation in 1980. He represented professionals, including engineers, attorneys, and judges, handling construction, insurance, and commercial disputes, representing both plaintiffs and defendants in multiple complex cases. In 1990, Judge Kaus joined a mid-sized San Francisco law firm, where he represented media, cable TV, and telecom clients in employment, contract, and franchising disputes. He chaired the litigation department, served on the executive committee, and handled construction cases involving major public buildings such as concert halls and hospitals. Also joining us tonight, David Michael Bigalizen brought 50 years of experience to each of his cases before his recent retirement. He began his career in New York City with Gilbert Rosenthal, the former president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. They worked together on the preparation and trial of a tax fraud case in the United States District Court. Mr. Bigalaisen's work caught the eye of a Wall Street tax lawyer. He joined the Wall Street firm. He worked on tax fraud, commercial fraud, securities fraud, and commodities matters. The lessons he learned on Wall Street have served his clients in white-collar cases ever since. In the summer of 1976, Mr. Bigalaisen moved his practice to San Francisco. One of his first projects was to help obtain the release of Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver. Mr. Bigalaisen has been a leader in the legal profession here in San Francisco. He's presented and supported legislation to end the death penalty, to decriminalize prostitution, to provide for pretrial diversion, which was not available in most counties, and to provide rehabilitation instead of punishment for people who should not be in jail at all. Well, without further ado, Judge Kaus, David Bigalaisen, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You know, I'd like to start with the big question for both of you. Why is judicial independence so important? Why are threats important? What does all this say? And what does it all mean to our republic?
Well, our government has, I think we all know from school, I think they still teach it somewhat, there are three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And ever since the first Chief Justice, John Marshall, established it, the role of the judicial, which has worked out pretty well for 250 years, has been to keep, one of their roles, is to keep the executive on the rails and have someone who is impartial decide if something either the executive or sometimes the legislature is doing violates the Constitution, violates other controlling statutes. And I think that's been key to the success of our country and preventing either the executive or the legislative from really violating the spirit of the country as expressed in the Constitution. The present climate now is to discredit the judicial branch so that people won't, we'll just see them as another political actor and not realize, and we can talk about it later, how judges are appointed, how they're retained, what their backgrounds are. Stephen Miller keeps speaking of communist judges. I think it's safe to say that none of the judges on the federal bench are communists. As like laughable. And Stephen Miller, of course, went to the district in Texas where he knew who the judge was going to be and got all sorts of orders to disrupt the Biden administration. So it's hypocritical, too. They also want to intimidate the judges and see if they can maybe not have to deal with bad rulings because the judges are scared, which in federal court is rough because they don't come up for election. And they threaten impeachment. There's never going to be impeachment. There aren't votes for impeachment, but it's something to talk about. And finally, there's a danger of physical harm, which has been very real in a number of cases. You know, ask Nancy Pelosi's husband and ask several judges who've been attacked. So it's important that we stand up for the role of the judiciary in keeping basically the country honest.
And you mentioned there'll never be an impeachment, but there is impeachment for judges themselves that go off the rails, whether it's bribes or whether it's doing things that themselves are inappropriate. But just a ruling or so that we don't like or disagreement about philosophy, there's never going to be an impeachment.
No, there have been very few impeachments in there for things like bribery and criminal conduct, not for voting to invalidate a presidential act.
You know, as Chief Roberts said, there are remedies if you don't like a judge's ruling. Traditionally, they've been appeals, not impeachment.
I want to remark on that, and that is Judge Roberts' remark, which was in response to Mr. Trump's threat to impeach Judge Boasberg, was extremely unusual. The Chief Justice of the United States has never made a comment such as that that any of us are aware of ever before, which means that even someone who sits in a very, 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 very restrained, narrow position has been concerned about the invasion that the executive has taken upon the judicial branch and the independence of the judiciary. It's quite remarkable.
Let's take a step back, start at the beginning, so that our listeners know, how does a judge take office? We'll start with the state court, and then we can go to federal court.
Two ways that judges take office. If there's a vacancy, then the governor will appoint a judge. The judicial candidates go through a very, very rigorous process of being examined by a commission of lawyers to make sure that they are fully qualified, both morally, legally, and with scholarship, and with the type of wisdom that one needs to make very important decisions in people's lives. With that, then the commission makes recommendations to the governor's appointment secretary. The governor then reviews those recommendations and appoints judges to vacant positions. When a judge's seat expires, and they typically are for 6 years, then if there's an open seat under those circumstances, then occasionally there is an election and we people vote for judges. Every once in a while, a sitting judge will face a challenge by someone who wants to remove that judge. General thinking among the legal profession is you never challenge a sitting judge under circumstances like that unless the judge has done something seriously wrong. And when I say seriously wrong, I don't mean a decision that you disagree with. I mean something like taking a bribe or some sort of bad misconduct in the judge's chambers, which comes up very, 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 very seldom.
You know, in a county like San Mateo or some of our other suburban counties, one would never run against a sitting judge because the judges protect one another. All their jobs are in jeopardy if they allow that to fly. But when you're in a county like San Francisco or Santa Clara, it's often been different where people run against sitting judges for different reasons.
Well, San Francisco, though, I think the only successful one I can recall wasn't it Judge Sandoval, who was a known political figure and therefore ran against someone who wasn't well-known and got himself elected? I think most of the attempts to defeat judges in San Francisco have also failed.
There was one judge who everybody kind of thought lived in San Mateo, which is okay, but to sit on the bench, you don't have to live in the county. But there was one maybe, I want to say 10 years ago, that was successful. But generally, it's a big undertaking.
The other way judges, every now and then a judge decides to just not run for re-election as opposed to resigning. And then there's an open election and candidates. That attracts more candidates because that's a fair fight. And often there'll be a couple or three people running and there'll be an election. I don't think it's the best way to pick a judge because I don't think the people voting have any idea who they're voting for. They may do it because of some identity politics, the first this or that to be a judge, and I don't think that's a very good way to pick judges.
There's also a tendency to vote, whether it's along identity lines, gender lines, things of that nature, also based on experience. Well, I want to elect the former DA or whatever. That's not always the best way.
Yeah, I think it's less of that now, but in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the law and order years when people like George Duke Machen were governor, DAs often ran against sitting judges, and the fact that it said DA got them elected. That happened twice in Contra Costa while I was a public defender out there, and it wasn't good, I don't think. I think it intimidated judges, and it skewed the results on the bench.
You know, contrast Alameda County with San Mateo County. They're about the political extremes of the Bay Area. In Alameda, a deputy district attorney who had a particular expertise in real property and the like and was prosecuting some of the real estate fraud, and he put his of course, his name is there, but when they refer to the occupation, he wrote it in the ballot designation as a real property expert and lawyer. They made him take it off and identify as a district attorney, and he came in third when there were three candidates. Same thing in San Mateo. You identify yourself as a district attorney, it'll trump just about anybody, including a court commissioner.
So I think for appellate judges, they say, shall so-and-so be elected for the term prescribed by law, yes or no? That's also questionable. But the idea of just having people run for judge, frankly, like they did in Wisconsin yesterday, is you can see what happened there. I don't think that that judge was elected because she had the right position on the statute of frauds. That's just not how an elected judge. It's not supposed to be a political position. It's supposed to apply the law. And I think in more cases than people realize, that's what happens. But it gets polluted by electoral politics.
And when you have somebody like Elon Musk coming in and throwing that kind of money around, I think it worked against
Could
the other candidate.
Fire.
It absolutely did. Well, let's contrast this with how federal judges are brought to office.
Federal judge is nominated by the president and appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate, which means that he needs a majority of the Senate in order to take a seat on the federal bench. That starts with the United States District Court judge, which is the trial judge, goes to the circuit court judges, and to the justices of the United States Supreme Court.
You know, before the current atmosphere in Washington, it was pretty standard. Both parties would support the other's nominations if they were duly qualified. Somewhere in the 2000s, one party got the idea to block all nominations from the other. And since then, it's become a very partisan issue. And with the Republican Congress, if a Democrat's in the White House, they tend to block all of the nominations. And similarly, if a Republican's have control of Congress and a Republican in the White House, everyone gets through.
Well, people get through, but they tend to be more toward the center. I've had friends that have nominated and they've gone through this process and they've all actually gotten through, but they're examined on everything they've ever written, including when they were a student. They are examined about who they represented, which is, getting into this topic of President Trump trying to tell lawyers who to represent. But you don't always agree with people who you represent, but you believe they have a right to be represented, starting with a public defender. They don't really identify with robbers and murderers, but they're entitled to a lawyer. That same is true of other things. And to accuse a judge nominee of identifying with what their client did or said is extremely unfair, and that's the kind of thing that has been going on now in Congress, and I don't know how it's ever going to get undone.
I think this is a good time to talk about the attacks that Mr. Trump has made on specific judges. And I'm going to begin with the judges that heard his cases in between the two times that he was president. He attacked Judge Merchan, who was trying his criminal case in New York County. He attacked Judge Erdogan, who was trying the civil fraud case. He attacked the United States District Court judge who was trying the lawsuits by E. Jean Carroll against him. And he also tried the New York State judge, or attacked the New York State judge who was trying the tax fraud case against his companies. He was also attacking United States District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan, who was hearing the case regarding the Capitol riots, and as well as the judge who was hearing the case regarding the Georgia fraud case.
But not Judge Eileen Cannon of Florida.
because Judge Cannon was making rulings that were favorable to him. Now, Steve, what do you think about all of that?
Well, obviously, it's part of the plan to discredit the judges rather than dealing with things on their merits. And we can stick to those things. You know, fairly obviously, he, I think, instigated the insurrection. And maybe you could say no, maybe a jury would say no. But it certainly was a fair prosecution to bring. Maybe it gets to a jury, maybe a judge throws it out before then. But that's the judicial process. But Trump has decided to discredit the judges, and that can only end up, I mean, now that he's president again, with a situation where the president is all powerful and there's no check on what the president does, which is antithetical to how this country is supposed to work.
Is that really the goal, do you believe, that the idea is to have a unitary president that doesn't have any checks and balances by the judiciary or the Congress?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, look, just look at, as I said, look at Stephen Miller, because he's got more words at his disposal than Trump does. The things he's saying about judges now who issue nationwide injunctions stopping the transgender ban in the military, stopping the deportation without a hearing of supposed Venezuelan gang members. They're communist judges. How can they have a nationwide injunction? They should be impeached.
And the
reality that's what he did for a living.
And the reality of one of those was the whole idea was, do they get due process? How do we prove? How do we have the opportunity to prove I was the wrong guy? I shouldn't be there. And it turns out they did get one of them wrong.
Well, they got more than one of them wrong. They sent, there was NBC News had a story today of two more women that were on the plane and were not allowed in and were sent back. The point is, we don't know the names of any of the people that were sent there except the ones they got wrong. And you are entitled under our concept of jurisprudence to at least a hearing, is your name Joe Blow, and here's the evidence against you, and a chance to show that you're not Joe Blow and you're not a member of the gang. And none of these people had it, and of course they made, quote, administrative errors, end quote, because they're very arrogant and they're now unchecked and think they can do whatever they want with no judicial prevention.
Let me take a step back. I want to pick up at this point, but before we do, these are not cases that the judge just jumped in and said, I want a piece of that. These aren't judges that are overseeing things. These are judges that are brought cases. How do they get their cases?
Well, for example, the Venezuelan one, which is somehow that's actually an issue, the ACLU and I believe another plaintiff went in and sought an emergency writ, and the judge issued one, first of all, for the named plaintiffs and set a hearing for that afternoon and held a hearing. So you need a party who's objecting to what is happening, and they have to have, quote, standing, end quote, which is, in federal court, is pretty narrowly construed. You have to have a personal stake in the matter in order to bring a suit. You can't, in California, you can bring a taxpayer's suit. Say, I paid property tax and what the government's doing is wrong. I can be a plaintiff, and you're right. But in federal court, you can't do that. You have to have a personal ox that's being gored before you can go into court.
So you go into court, your lawyers are there to protect you. They will file whatever it is, whether it's an emergency writ or whatever the case is. And then is it just, does any judge get to grab it, or is it usually assigned cases?
There is, it's now computerized. There are various judges who are eligible to be assigned certain kinds of cases. In federal court, I think most of the judges are eligible for all cases. So you get a patent case, a criminal case, and oh, look at this, a writ to try to prevent the President of the United States from issuing an order to the military. And it's just what comes down the chute. And in federal court, absent someone disqualifying themselves or some other appellate court disqualifying them, both of which are pretty rare, you are stuck with that judge. In state court, you get one challenge, and just basically you say the judge is prejudiced against me, you get another judge. You can do that once for each case. It's an escape valve.
In federal court, the cases are assigned to the judges at random. When you file your case, the clerk goes, they used to use a wheel that was similar to what they would use at the church lottery. Now they use a computer to do it, but it's done at random. You don't know which judge you're going to get when you walk in.
And similarly, the judges don't get to pick and choose their cases based on interest, based on what they think is a good thing to do or get involved in.
It's a judicial canon that you are supposed to judge every case that is assigned to you. You're not supposed to find reasons to disqualify yourself. In the absence of a real disqualification, a bias, or an interest in the case, you are supposed to decide it.
So with that in mind, these are judges where they've been thrown a hot potato, and yet they're duty-bound to follow through and do the research and go where the evidence and the law takes them.
Yeah, this probably wasn't how Judge Boasberg was planning on spending a Saturday a couple of weeks ago. You know, there's one exception, and that is if a case is related to another case, often it'll be assigned to the judge who had the first case, and often they can either accept it or not under those circumstances. And the law firm cases, all of which were filed in Washington, D.C., and they've been assigned to three different judges, the law firms who objected to Trump's order. And I wonder if they did that on purpose to spread that around, because those cases seem related to me. Maybe they decided they weren't, but that's a strange thing that those were assigned to three different judges.
And next week, our show is dedicated to those attacks on the law firms, to the executive orders, where the administration has basically taken a position that if a firm stands up to something they're doing, we're going to do everything we can to revoke their ability to get into federal buildings, to lose any credentialing they had, to go after them for sanctions. Some of the things that they're doing have really put in question what is happening with the legal system. But that's next week's show. This, with the idea of how these cases are assigned, how nobody's jumping in and saying, wait, I want to be the guy, I want to be sitting in your shoes and second-guessing you as the picture is being painted from the administration. Now we look at the attacks on the judges coming from the president. And what does it mean when the president is able to completely come in with a completely different message, reconstrue what the judge did, and throw attacks on the judges? Is that meant to intimidate?
I think that without any doubt that that action against the judges, against the courts, and also against the lawyers is a direct attack on the legal system. Steve, you and I spoke about the effect of that on the Republic. Do you want to pick that up now or after station break?
I think that's a topic that we could spend a minute or two on, so we'll pick that up after the station break. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're here looking at threats to the judiciary and the rule of law. With the help of Stephen Kaus, retired judge of the Alameda County Superior Court, and David Michael Bigelisen, attorney retired of San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. You didn't have to jump in where we are in our conversation. You can have any question about the independence, about the courts, about the workings of our democracy. You don't have to jump in where we are in our conversation. But you are listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So right before we broke, you were asking the question, David, pick it up again.
Okay, and that is, what is the effect of the attacks on the bench, on the courts, and on the lawyers, and how does that affect the republic and the future of our government?
Well, first of all, Trump's very effective at this. He did it during his first term against certain specific judges, not so much against every judge. He did it against the media, and you could see the effect that's had on the extent to which people believe the media and rely on the media. In other countries that have systems of government where I wouldn't want to live, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Russia, China, there's not an independent judiciary.
So there's nobody to put up any railing.
There isn't, and that's why those are called dictatorships and authoritarian. I mean, Trump is in a very broad way expanding his power, and he's following the playbook of people like Orban in Hungary. He's putting sycophants in charge of all governmental departments. I mean, look at the FBI. Who could be less appropriate than Kash Patel? He should be investigated by the FBI, not running it. Institutions of culture, the idea of taking over the Kennedy Center, that's the kind of thing, if you read Ann Althaus's book, Twilight of Democracy, the country she's talking about, I must say, I think it was Poland, the president put some idiot cousin in charge of the National Library and took over all the cultural institutions like that. It's all part of the playbook. And, of course, preventing the judges from having the independent power is part of the playbook. And the problem is going to be if the judges have the courage to rule against Trump, how are they going to enforce it? Is Trump going to really have increased his power to the point where he can just muscle his way through, like they did with Judge Boasberg and the flights to Venezuela? He ordered that they stopped, and they just said, who cares, and took off anyway. Said, oh, well, you didn't put it in writing. That's not how it works.
Let me turn it over to John from Redwood City. John, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks so much. I think you started answering the question I had. What recourse is there if Trump disregards a court order?
We don't know, because it has never come to that.
Well, there are a couple of things. Of the example of the case in Venezuela, Judge Boasberg is going to have to make some decisions, and the government is going to have to decide whether they're going to obey his rulings or not. If they decide not to obey his rulings, one of the things he'll have to consider is to hold some of the people who are responsible for disobeying his rulings in contempt. If they're held in contempt, he has the power to place them in jail until they obey. Now, the problem with that is that the people who put the people in jail are the United States Marshal Service. The United States Marshal Service is under the jurisdiction of the United States Department of Justice, and the United States Attorney, the Attorney General, is Pam Bondi, who has been doing Mr. Trump's bidding. So this is potentially a very, very serious constitutional crisis that we're facing. Stated otherwise, and I'm not understating at all, the republic is very likely to be in great peril.
So the real question that poses.
So that doesn't answer the question, unfortunately. We don't have a good answer. If Trump decides to be the unitary executive and order everybody under his command to not follow the judge's orders, the judge doesn't have a lot of power, and our country kind of falls apart.
Won't some judges, understandably, take the path of least resistance and modify their ruling so they don't take on the wrath of Trump?
Not supposed to. Steve?
That's right. You're not supposed to, but they're human beings. And particularly if they're physical threats, I mean, judges don't have protection from people coming and threatening them. Somebody was arrested and charged who was right by Judge Kavanaugh's house. And a judge in New Jersey, a lawyer who was somewhat, I think, feeble-minded at that point, broke in, killed her son, critically wounded her husband. I mean, there's no protection against that, and I don't believe Trump is going to provide it.
Individual judges, for the most part, don't get Secret Service protection the way that the way that other officials might.
I don't even know if the Supreme Court does. I suppose they probably do. But no, not at all. You just live in a house on the block like everyone else. I guess you try to be incognito.
There are instances where people who are attacking judges do things like sending fake Domino's pizzas to the judges' houses, sending a covert message, "We know where you live."
Oh, that's for sure.
So these are all intended to be intimidations, and they are egged on by Mr. Trump.
John, I'm sorry we didn't have better answers for you. These are fairly dangerous times.
Yeah, it's sobering. Thank you for sharing. Appreciate the show.
Thank you for joining us. So is that really what all this is? Is it a question of a bluff when they talk impeachment to try to get people to change their rulings? Or is there more of a threat behind it? If I don't like your rulings, you don't get Secret Service protection. I mean, where does this all go?
Well, you don't get it anyway. In order to impeach someone, you would have to convince a majority of the House. They have a majority, but would a majority really impeach a judge for making a ruling? We don't know. But then, as we found out with Trump's impeachments, you need two-thirds of the Senate. And it's pretty clear to me that there's not two-thirds of the Senate. I mean, obviously, there's the Democrats are more than a third, so that would never happen. So it's basically a threat. It's basically theater. And it's devaluing the judicial position, which is not subject to removal for making a decision that the president and Stephen Miller don't agree with. And they're trying to act like it should be.
Let me turn it to Edward from Alameda. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you so very much. Probably a simple question here, but going back to the discussion, that the point that was raised that the U.S. Marshals are under the Department of Justice, Pam Bondi is with the DOJ. When we are looking at that and we are looking at this point of potential constitutional crisis, the question that I have is what direct action is available to the American populace, not just on a legal matter, but where can we be able to direct our resources when we are in this position? Thank you.
I think that that's one of the reasons that we're going on the radio tonight, and that is to educate the public about what all of these things mean and to educate the public about what an independent judiciary means in terms of preserving the republic. Some of these questions that you're bringing up are political and will need to be dealt with in the political realm. But in the meantime, you should be talking with your friends about this and what this means to every single one of you. What does it mean to the individual when the courts are being attacked in this way, not only in the big picture of things, but also in individual areas? I spoke with a friend of mine who's in her early 30s, and she said, I asked her, "Denise, what does this mean to you?" And she said, "This is going to come up in an important way when it comes to reproductive rights." That's just one example. There are many, many, many other personal things that it has to do with. And Steve, why don't you put in a couple of examples?
Well, I'm preaching to the choir, I think, in Northern California, but political is the first thing, and unfortunately, we lost. I retired from the court. I went to Pennsylvania and knocked on doors for 10 days, and we failed. Trump won. So politically, probably the midterm elections is our chance to really put a major roadblock there. So it's something of a four-corner offense until then.
Is it enough to show up at the midterms and vote, or for people that are able to maybe take some time and knock on doors in other states?
Obviously, there's various levels of effectiveness. I think everyone, I mean, this is a different topic. I'm happy I went and knocked on doors. I'm unhappy that it didn't accomplish more. But, you know, this is a totally corrupt administration, going a little beyond the topic here. Look at the people that Trump has pardoned. He is pardoning every single white-collar criminal who's being prosecuted by the Justice Department. He is prosecuting fraudsters. I mean, he let the mayor of New York go, who's now turned into a sort of, what are you in a cult, a majordomo? He's a majordomo in the Trump cult after having been elected as a Democrat. This is just like every other strongman, authoritarian government. He is allowing criminal behavior on the part of his allies in return for their support. And I'm not going to accuse Elon Musk of criminal behavior, but he's allowing him to dismantle the government where it serves poor people while he collects billions of dollars of subsidies from the government himself. This is corruption, and we have to hope that the judges can hang on and make rulings, and they will be respected by people and enforced.
Let me turn to Peter from Florida. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Okay, here's my situation. So my mother passed away a year and a half ago, and there was, my father had died a few years earlier, and there was just me and my brother were the only, whatever, to divide the estate among me and my brother. And you know, I got things from her life insurance. All that seems to have worked out fine. The one thing, though, is when she died, she had a car, a Tesla, okay? My brother took the car. So let me put it this way. I'm blind. He's not blind. My brother took the car, and I deserve half the value of that car, right? That's my understanding. Half the value of that car, its value when it was bought. Or help me out with this. He owes me money, and I have to get the money from him. How do I do that?
Well, that's a really tough question for us to answer because we haven't seen your mother's will or if your parents left a trust. Plus also, neither I nor any of my guests, to my understanding, are or have been licensed to practice in Florida. Where was your mother when she passed?
In Florida.
That would be a factor of state law. The state law does have presumptions for how things pass from one person, you know, from the decedent to somebody else. And we're all very sympathetic. I'm sorry that your mother and your parents have passed, but that's a really hard question to answer. Let me turn it to Steve Kaus. Do you have any suggestions for him?
Maybe a local bar association has an Ask a Lawyer Day when you could go and just get pointed in the right direction. Or I assume Florida has small claims court. If the Tesla value continues to decline, maybe you could go to small claims court and see if you could get some redress there. I don't know what the jurisdiction limit would be in Florida, though.
Okay, so like small claims court, and you said and local bar, like somewhere near me? What was that first suggestion?
Exactly. The local bar associations in California. Now, I can't speak for Florida, but most of the country, the local bar associations have a lawyer referral service of one form or another where you can spend a fairly nominal amount of money, $30, $40, $50, and get a consultation with a lawyer and it varies by association, half an hour. You can shop to see if that's a lawyer you want. You could also just bend their ear and see what they can help you with.
Local bar and get a loyal refer or a question and answer type thing, right?
Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. I wish we had more ability to be of help, but it's Florida and we just don't have the knowledge of Florida law.
I'm not sure we would in California either, but that's okay.
Let me turn it to Athena from Toronto. Athena, welcome to your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening. So I have a question. Based on what we've seen so far, it looks like Trump is going to likely to attempt to remove these judges without any sort of due process or following any established rules of law. He's already shown that he's perfectly willing to ignore both the Fifth and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. So what's the actual legal process for removing a sitting judge? Like, what would he have to do to legally remove a sitting judge from bench? And how does that set of strictures, how does that help to strengthen the judiciary's independence?
Want me to field that one? I have a little bit of experience
In federal court?
With working with a federal judge who went through some of that. So it would start with the House of Representatives. And one of the representatives would draw up articles of impeachment. They would then take it to the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives. They would make a recommendation to the Congress as a whole. In the event the Congress makes the decision that they want to proceed with articles of impeachment, they would pass them. The case would go on to the Senate. The House would appoint so-called House managers, and they act as the attorneys that take the case before the Senate where the case is tried. Exactly what happens in the Senate is completely up for grabs. There have been cases where no evidence was produced to the Senate as a whole. They designated individuals to look at it and then report back. The Supreme Court has not gotten involved. They have said it's really up to the Senate to make their own rules. So it's a very complicated situation. But ultimately, it takes 2/3 of the sitting senators to go along with it in order to remove a sitting judge.
And it's done for serious things, not, again, because the president doesn't like you or because of your judicial opinions. Alcee Hastings was impeached in 1989 for bribery. It became somewhat controversial when he became a congressperson later, and the question was, would he be put in charge of the Foreign Relations Committee or the Judicial Committee? And then another judge, Thomas Porteous, was removed for lying and accepting bribes in 2010. There are lesser sanctions. There's a Judicial Conference of the United States which can censure judges or reprimand them or suspend case assignments and maybe sort of de facto remove them. But none of the things Trump's talking about have ever been thought to be grounds for removal of a judge. It would really be almost an insurrection for him to do it.
Okay, and it sounds like it's a fairly complicated process that could drag on for like years if the Senate can't come to some sort of consensus.
If it happens, we've got a lot of problems over and above that, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay.
And
thank you guys so much.
And putting in perspective, there is typically in the neighborhood of 2,000 federal judges at any given time, and the number of impeachments probably are closer to a dozen that have actually gone through.
I don't know how many.
And that's over the history of being able to impeach them.
It's always been thought that there's no more insulated position in government in the United States than an Article III federal judge. And that is being put to a stress test at the moment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, because that clarifies what the actual process is. Like I said, even though he seems to be perfectly comfortable ignoring those things.
In large part, it would so appear. But I think some of that is that whether you like the president, whether you like his policies or not, you have to give him that. If nothing else, he's a marketing genius.
I mean, I don't think he's going to get together a bunch of Proud Boys and go down to the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C. and march Judge Boasberg out at gunpoint. That would be quite... That would have nothing to do with the law. Let's put it that way.
Well, given that I'm calling you from a country whose sovereignty he has directly threatened, you know, I am actually monitoring this quite closely just because it gives an indication of what he is and isn't willing to do.
But there's another factor involved in that, which is also extra legal. But at some point...
Absolutely.
At some point, do military officials say, wait, this is further than even we're willing to go.
Not anymore, my opinion. He got rid of them all.
And this is why I'm watching all of the legal shenanigans that are occurring south of this border quite closely.
Right now, there's a race underway. And that race, as I see it, is how much he could change the world in his first 2 years. Because I do expect the midterms, as it's now, as the system is now structured, he will suffer major losses in the midterm elections. The question is, can he cook the books enough in the next 2 years to where that's no longer on the table?
That's going to come up in another way, and that is with regard to the cases that are now pending that have to do with voting rights and the attempts of the administration to limit the opportunity, the availability, and the right of people to cast their ballots.
No doubt.
And I don't think that they will outwardly deny people their vote. I think what's far more likely and perhaps a little more sinister is that the vote you have will be far less meaningful than what we've known. We'll have much less information, the information we tightly controlled. There will be less of a check. That's what I see happening. I just don't see that we will have truly informed and meaningful choices the way that we have in the past. Do you see that as well?
Well, I think the main problem I see is that these things are handled at local levels. And if MAGA activists become election workers and do the kind of shenanigans they did in 2020, they could affect the outcome. They could physically do something to ballots. They could report erroneous results, and it would be very hard to unwind. So, unfortunately, one of the things that Trump's destroyed is the whole civic aspect of working on elections where people win or lose counted the votes. And that's, I'm afraid, gone by the boards.
Athena, thank you for joining us. I wish we had a better view of where things were going.
Even if you can't forecast the future, at least knowing what the rules are that aren't being followed is really vital. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And while we're not quite at the end of the hour, I did offer that I would give each of you a few minutes for any of your final thoughts, anything you wanted to express. Who would like to jump in? Take about 3 minutes.
I'll speak first. I went to the law because I wanted to know what the rules were, and I wanted to know what the rules are that people need to follow. The rules now are in great danger. One of the very first things that Adolf Hitler did was to dismantle the legal system. Jeffrey, how long did it take him to dismantle the legal system in Germany?
53 days.
Okay, well, it's been a little bit longer than that, but those of us who have an institutional memory of that, as having been taught by our parents and our grandparents, are very, very aware of it, and I think that we are facing that kind of crisis right now.
We've had more modern, more recent cases where leaders have done the same thing. I mean, we see it with Erdogan in Turkey right now.
Yeah, he's a very good example. But also, I mean, Russia and China, which are the judiciary has no independence. Oh, whoa, whoa, Putin, you can't declare that war. That's a sovereign country. I mean, that wasn't going to happen in Russia, and I think Judge Boasberg would be well advised to stay away from windows.
But neither of those countries, Russia and China, had a history, a tradition of being democratic. Russia went there for 5 minutes.
It's true. It's true. You know, I'm happy to just talk very briefly on what I think is next week's topic and try to shame the lawyers in this country to stand up to Trump rather than cutting deals with him. They say they're not being infringed in terms of who they're going to represent, but it is absolutely contrary to all the principles of the duties of lawyers to agree with someone essentially that you're not going to go into court and oppose what they're doing. The people who are questioning what Trump is doing need good representation. And the idea that the law firm where Doug Imhoff, Kamala Harris's husband, works, has now cut a deal with Trump where they promise not to practice illegal DEI and will not let political considerations affect who they represent, that's absurd. They have every right to have political considerations govern who they represent. This is the United States of America. And, you know, the legal community, the big boy legal community, is sort of like college athletics now, except there's no transfer portal. Everybody comes in on Monday, and there are a bunch of new lawyers who have been hired away from other firms, and a bunch of empty chairs for those who have been hired away. And it's nothing but avarice, and it's a pollution of the whole idea of the legal profession.
And as you said, we're going to be talking about that. That is the subject of next week's show, is the idea that anybody, including the president, can so bully the lawyers to where people that have a legitimate problem have nowhere to go. Your government wants to send you away. You've lived here your whole life. Maybe you were born here, but you look like somebody, and they're going to throw you out, and there's nowhere you could go to talk about it. Or you've been serving in the military for 15 years, and suddenly they decided that they don't like your lifestyle, so you're out when you've done nothing, and there's nowhere you can go. Is that really where we're headed? That's next week's show.
Who are we going to have next week, Jeffrey?
Next week, we have probably the most active firm in the region to participate in this. If you have a chance to read articles written by Kecker, Van Nest,
and Peters,
those three are going to be with us. Read their op-eds, have a chance to look and see what's really going on. Be ready for next week's show. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've discussed myriad threats to the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law. Our guests tonight have been David Michael Bigelizen of San Francisco and retired judge of the Alameda County Superior Court, Stephen Kaus. I hope each of you will be back again. Please join Your Legal Rights next week, where beginning at 6, we will conclude this series with a look at the attack on the legal profession, that is, taking away where you could go for help. Best of all, as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks again to our guests. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Hello, this is James Cass, Executive Director of KALW. We can all see it. Independent journalism is facing real threats, but we are standing strong. Beginning April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation and ensures that every voice is heard. We're committed to truth and storytelling that connects our communities, but we can't do it alone, so let's do this together. Invest in KALW, because the future starts now.